This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. Thousands of people gathered in central Moscow today to rally in support of jailed Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny, answering his call for nationwide protests against President Vladimir Putin's rule. Demonstrators gathered at Moscow's central Pushkin Square and nearby streets, despite a heavy police presence and detentions, holding signs that read, "Russia will be free," and chanting, "Putin is a thief." Some then marched towards the Kremlin, while others blocked the Russian capital's main thoroughfare. Navalny called on his allies to take to the streets after he was detained in a Moscow airport last weekend. He was arrested moments after arriving from Germany, where he had flown in August to recover from a near-fatal poisoning with a Soviet-designed nerve agent. Police detained hundreds of people in cities in the Far East and Siberia earlier Saturday, where demonstrators braved icy temperatures and official warnings, and at least 2,000 of Navalny's supporters gathered in Russia's second city of St. Petersburg. This week, Navalny released a video investigation alleging that Putin was the owner of a palatial property on the Black Sea worth more than $1 billion. The video report has been viewed more than 66 million times. Thousands of Hong Kong residents are locked down in an unprecedented move to contain a worsening coronavirus outbreak in the city. Hong Kong has been grappling to contain a fresh wave of the coronavirus since November, and over 4,300 cases in the last 2 months have made up nearly 40% of the city's total. Coronavirus infections in a working-class neighborhood with old buildings and subdivided flats made up about half of the city's new cases in the past week. This is VOA News. In the United States, famed broadcaster Larry King has died at age 87. He was known for wearing suspenders to hold up his pants, but also for his conversational interviews with world leaders, movie stars, and ordinary people. King died at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles, according to multiple sources. No cause of death was given, but CNN reported on January 2nd that King had been hospitalized with COVID-19. He was a longtime nationally syndicated radio host, and from 1985 through 2010, he was a nightly fixture on CNN. King conducted an estimated 50,000 on-air interviews. In 1995, he presided over a Middle East peace summit with PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat, King Hussein of Jordan, and Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. He welcomed on his show the likes of the Dalai Lama, Barack Obama, Bill Gates, and Lady Gaga. A few other interesting facts about the broadcaster: his show Larry King Live debuted in 1985, and became CNN's highest-rated program. At the time, he was paid $100,000 a year, but his salary eventually grew to more than $7 million. He at one time smoked 3 packs of cigarettes a day until he had a heart attack in 1987, and he was married 8 times to 7 different women, one he married twice. And here are some interesting facts about America's new president, Joe Biden. At 78 years old, he is the oldest newly inaugurated U.S. chief executive in history and the oldest sitting president ever. Biden was born in 1942, and at that time, the population of the U.S. was 135 million. Today, it's approaching 330 million, and the world population has grown from 2.3 billion in 1942 to 7.8 billion today. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is saying that the new English variant of COVID-19 may be associated with a higher level of mortality, although he said evidence showed that both vaccines being used in the country are effective against it. Johnson said that the impact of the new variant, which is already known to be more transmissible, was putting the health service under intense pressure. And Australia's Victoria state recorded its 17th straight day without any new local coronavirus cases on Saturday, as officials focus on keeping the community separated from staff and players in the country for next month's Australian Open. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
Continue to urge international and regional actors to push the Ugandan government to do. It's, I think, a collective responsibility, not just of human rights organizations, but the global community to urge Uganda to fulfill its obligations towards its citizens and people living here whose rights have been abused.
Human Rights Watch compiles instances of human rights violations in the run-up to Uganda's recent presidential and legislative elections.
Zambians do have an opportunity to see which group of people is going to meet their aspirations, and those are the ones who are going to emerge victorious if the election is free and fair.
Zambia's main opposition, United Party for National Development, or UPND, announces plans to organize elections to elect leaders of the group on February 14.
At the airport, it's different. Security will force you to go for quarantine, but those coming through land borders, they're not going or taking them to quarantine. They only verify the documents you have, you know, carry tests on you, and they allow you to leave. This is what I am trying to put emphasis on.
And in the Gambia, an opposition party expresses concern that the government appears unable to address a second wave of the coronavirus. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Human Rights Watch says it has compiled instances of human rights violations in the run-up to Uganda's recent presidential and legislative elections. According to its latest report, the right abuses included killings carried out by security forces, as well as beatings of supporters of opponents of the government. Civil society and opposition groups backed details of the report. They also added that human rights violations are ongoing. This after citing the ongoing house arrest of Robert Kyagulanyi Ssentamu, also known as Bobi Wine. Local media report Wine's house has been surrounded by security forces who prevent anybody from going into his home or coming out. He was the presidential candidate of the opposition National Unity Platform, or NUP, in the recent elections. To learn more about Human Rights Watch report about the situation leading up to the recent elections in Uganda, I reach Oriem Nyeko, African researcher at Human Rights Watch.
So we found that during the weeks leading up to the elections in Uganda, there was a myriad of rights abuses that took place, including the killing of protesters, the disruption of opposition rallies very violently by security forces, opposition members, including two presidential candidates, were arrested several times during the campaign season. And the media was heavily restricted. Journalists were blocked from doing their work and were in some instances actually shot at by security officers.
Supporters of the ruling party have denied reports of human rights abuses and that the security agencies were simply ensuring that the country does not degenerate into chaos. What do you say to that?
International law requires security forces to act with restraint when quelling protests or when dispersing crowds. Many of the rights abuses that took place in Uganda simply were not justified because the security forces didn't act with restraint. I think that the perpetrators of the killings and of the shootings of journalists, for example, should be held to account as is required under Ugandan law itself.
Oriem, some civil society groups and human rights defenders have come under some criticism, with critics saying that they appear to have been quiet with Bobi Wine and other opposition groups being supposedly silenced, and in the case of Bobi Wine, being under house arrest immediately following the elections. Do you think the criticisms are justified?
I think that if any civil society groups have been quiet during this period, I think that's something that is to be reasonably expected given how repressive the government has been towards its critics and to opposing views in the last couple of weeks and over the course of a very long period. Many civil society organizations have faced threats, as have activists who have spoken out about rights abuses in Uganda, including a very prominent human rights lawyer called Nicholas Opiyo, who was arrested last month and accused of money laundering. So if groups have been silent, I think it's not hugely surprising in such a climate of fear and repression.
Oriam, at the moment, what is the human rights situation following the conclusion of the just ended presidential and parliamentary elections in Uganda?
I think the big question mark is about accountability for the many abuses that took place in the past few weeks and months. How and what form that will take if it comes to be. Bobi Wine is still under house arrest, although the High Court is supposed to rule on that on Monday. So we wait that decision. There's also been reports of continued disappearances of opposition members, which we continue to investigate. I think generally there's a sense of resignation, though, and feeling of wanting to move forward for many Ugandans at the moment.
But do you think the administration will prosecute or perhaps hold accountable those accused of allegedly violating the rights of individuals believed to have violated the law, perhaps?
I mean, the government doesn't have a very good track record of holding human rights abusers accountable. We have the laws in place. We actually have a law that is specifically designed to hold security officers accountable for human rights abuses, individually liable. We have the Human Rights Enforcement Act. But I think in spite of the lack of action that the government has taken to hold those individuals responsible, it's still important to call for them to, for the government to do its job, to perform its responsibility, which is what we continue to urge them to do. And also continue to urge international and regional actors to push the Ugandan government to do. It's, I think, a collective responsibility, not just of human rights organizations, but the global community, to urge Uganda to fulfill its obligations towards its citizens and people living here whose rights have been abused.
Where does Uganda go from here in terms of the respect for human rights and to ensure that officials or security institutions do not violate the rights of Ugandans?
I think a cynical person would probably say that things are likely to get worse or at the very least stay the same, which isn't necessarily a good thing given what has been happening recently. But I think that it's important, as I said earlier, to note that there are mechanisms in place in Uganda and regionally that can be used to hold individuals to account.
Oriam Nyako is Africa's researcher at Human Rights Watch. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Zambia's main opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND, plans to organize a general assembly to elect leaders of the group on February 14. Representatives say all positions will be open for candidates who meet the party's requirements to contest. The party last held its leadership election in 2012, prompting accusations of hypocrisy and lack of internal party democracy. Critics also say the delay violates the country's constitution. They accuse Hakainde Hichilema, presidential candidate of the party since 2012, of preventing any internal challenge, an accusation he denies. To learn more about efforts to organize elections for the opposition party, I reached Gary Nkombo, the UPND's elections chairman.
It was basically an announcement of postponement due to the circumstances that are indicated that beyond our control, and they are as follows. We are challenged with the coronavirus, and basically as a responsible grouping, we should have brought about 1,600 people, plus or minus, to one central place where we were going to look at our constitution and maybe effect amendments if need be, based on the submissions that have been given by our party members. And the second agenda item was going to be elections to choose office bearers, obviously after the dissolution of the current leaders, in order to usher in new office bearers for the next 5 years.
Will there be any restrictions with regards to any position that is a no-go area?
Okay, thank you for that question. It keeps popping up from time to time, and I was very clear, as a matter of fact, yesterday in my statement. I said that all positions, to the exception of none, are under contestation. So there is no position that is protected. Every position is open for contestation. Having said so, I must also be quick to say there are terms and conditions that are attached to eligibility of who should contest, and one of which is one requires to be a bona fide member of the organization. And because that is the case, we are hedging against infiltration. You know, we are working in an open political dispensation. And so if we want to contest, they must, first of all, prove their membership and that they are in good standing with the club, that they have no disciplinary issues, that basically those are the two qualifications that allows one to contest any position. And obviously it goes without saying that one needed to have been a member in good standing for at least a period not less than 2 years.
I've heard some political parties, including the PF members, accusing the UPND of lacking party internal democracy, because it has been a very long time since the UPND held a general assembly to choose leadership, and that your presidential candidate has remained a presidential candidate for more than 2 terms without any possible challenge of being contested in a general assembly. So they said this assembly forms part of the effort trying to move away from that tag of lacking party internal democracy. How do you react to such assertion?
I would say that that is misleading, completely misleading, because a long time is not definitive. We had our last General Assembly in 2012, and if you want to call that a long time, you know, it's relative to your mind. So we had our last General Assembly in 2012, and because of the challenges that we've been facing vis-a-vis what I just explained to you, there have been so many presidential by-elections that have come, and general elections that have come in the way, it basically has presented a challenge for us to meet. So we are about a year or so late into having our General Assembly. And, you know, the same applies to the people that are ringing the bells now to say that UPND does not have internal democracy. The fact of the matter is, it is true that at the point of contesting the presidency, we have been very clear ourselves that if something is not broken, we should not fix it. And so our current presidency remains the best sellable product to the Zambian people, and we will prove that when we go to on Valentine's Day, on the 14th, if he will go through the elections contested or uncontested.
With this announcement, what message does the UPND want to send to the people of Zambia, and by extension, prospective voters who would want to vote for the party ahead of the elections?
I think that the message for the UPND has been very clear. And so clear that they know that the current trajectory of PF is not leading us in the right direction. And I think that many Zambians know that. Therefore, it goes without saying that there is a problem, and the problem is leadership. And now we do have a grocery or menu of other leaders who want to contest this election. The contestation is not limited to PF and UPND only. There are other political parties. So Zambians do have an opportunity to see which group of people is going to meet their aspirations. And those are the ones who are going to match victorious if the elections is free and fair.
Gary Nkombo is the chairman of elections for the Zambian main opposition, United Party for National Development, UPND. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. In the Gambia, the Opposition Alliance for Patriotic Reorientation and Construction, or APRC, is expressing concern that the government appears unprepared to address a second wave of the coronavirus. The party says local media reports show officials are yet to implement measures to stop the spread of the disease in the West African country. But supporters of the government reject their criticisms as false. They cited measures the administration has implemented to stop the spread of the disease. The use of a global coronavirus pandemic to score cheap political points, the supporters argue, is shameful and unpatriotic. Dudu Jah is the executive secretary and deputy secretary of the Gambian Opposition Alliance for Patriotic Reorientation and Construction, or APRC. He tells me that the government has yet to educate citizens that fighting the coronavirus is a collective responsibility, which he argues is the best way to stop the spread of the disease.
They are confirming cases, mainly they're saying from UK. And at the moment, it's our airport that they're fighting. People coming from the diaspora are forcefully taking under quarantine that they have to be tested, even though most of them are coming with documents that show proof of them taking the test from the various European countries or the diaspora where they hail from, but to the extent the police have been stationed at the airport to make sure they will enforce people to undergo quarantine. But inside the country and across the borders or all border checkpoints, we are not seeing any stringent measures being taken. It's only the airport as of now. And people are not adhering to most of these regulations put forward by the World Health Organization, that is social distancing, wearing of masks, washing of hands, etc. Most people are not adhering to it nowadays.
Dudu, some Gambians are expressing concern that it does not appear that the government has what it takes or has prepared adequately enough to combat the second wave of the coronavirus infection in the Gambia. Is that the stance of your party?
That's the stance of some Gambians. It is what we have seen and what is on the ground. And the complaints we are receiving from those they've taken to quarantine, most of them said even if they reach at the various hotels where they're taking them for quarantine, there are no doctors on the ground. They'll have to stay there and wait for doctors to come later and perform the tests that they need to do. I believe if we have to take it seriously, the ground should be fully prepared, well equipped, and there should be staff on the ground whereby immediately as people arrive, you'll be able to do the test right away and make all the checkups you want with them. But if you leave them under security, who knows? People could sneak out, and what if they've come with something or they're infected? The likelihood is they will get in contact with other people. So I believe from the airport, if you insist on quarantine, the ground should be level and they're well equipped to the extent when people arrive, these checkups should be done. I believe the government is trying its best, but they have to, you know, do more in order not to scare people about the information they're giving.
But Dudu Jah, supporters of the government are saying that these reports that your party is hammering on is not true, and that adequate preparations have been made, and that is why people who come from outside the country who enters the shores of the Gambia are quarantined, then they are tested to ensure that they don't infect the population. Why do you disagree?
Mr. Peter, like I mentioned earlier, it's the airport at the moment where security is stationed and they're checking people thoroughly. When you go to the border, it's a different scenario. Like all other entry points are not as secured as the airport is. People could criticize, that is fine. but people are crossing the border into the country from neighboring countries, Senegal, Guinea-Bissau, etc., and they are not taking to quarantine. When you come, they just ask for documentation that would prove that you did the quarantine test. Just this last Wednesday, I picked people at the border point called Jiboro. They were from Guinea-Bissau. They only have to show that they have these documents. They will just perform a test and allow you entry. At the airport, it's different. Security will force you to go for quarantine. But those coming through land borders, they're not going or taking them to quarantine. They only verify the documents you have, you know, carry test on you, and they allow you to leave. This is what I am trying to put emphasis on.
What does your party suggest or is proposing as the best way forward in terms of implementing medical decisions or policies to prevent the spread of the coronavirus in the Gambia?
Mr. Peter, for us, we believe it's a collective responsibility. We're all Gambians, and it's a concern to all of us. As stakeholders, they should try to create a platform where the stakeholders as well would help in information dissemination and sensitizing the masses. And when I talk about stakeholders, not only political parties, I'm talking about the private sector, the businessmen, or the business personnel. They all have a role to play here.
Duduja is the executive secretary and deputy secretary of the Gambian Opposition Alliance for Patriotic Reorientation and Construction, or APRC. He spoke with me from the capital, Banjul. Nigerian authorities reopened schools across the country on January 18, despite a jump in confirmed cases of COVID-19. But while millions of students are excited to return to class, health authorities are urging caution. For VOA, Timothy Obiezo reports from the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
Linguistics student Esther Ajayi had just started her freshman year when COVID-19 hit last year and closed her Abuja school for months. Nigerian authorities allowed schools to reopen this week despite a rise in the number of coronavirus cases.
I feel happy resuming back to school because, to be sincere, it was boring staying at home. So when me resuming back to school today, I have the opportunity to meet some of my friends again.
Besides COVID-19, unresolved payment disputes between Nigerian authorities and teachers also delayed school resumption last year, but both parties reached an agreement in December. But not everyone is pleased about the school's reopening. Nigerian health unions say conditions are still too dangerous.
Then you are risking those kids, you're risking the teachers, you're risking the families, and at the end of the day, who are going to suffer? It's we, the healthcare providers. We are going to suffer. We have more work on our hands.
Many Abuja schools recorded low attendance this week, days after Nigeria reported its highest daily number of coronavirus infections, over 1,800 cases. School authorities are operating shorter hours and using social media platforms to send lesson notes to students. Every school is expected to create its own student-led COVID-19 task force and monitor students' compliance with measures to prevent the spread of the virus. Muhammad Buhari is the student union president at Zuba College of Education in Abuja.
So they will be in charge to enforce the law of COVID-19 protocol in every school. They will be the one going around to see how the students are doing in the campuses, because staying at home is doing us more harm.
While schools are staying open for now, authorities say they will monitor COVID-19 cases in coming weeks to see if they need to reconsider. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
Join and Counter host Carol Castiel and a panel of experts as they discuss the implications of the transfer of power as Joseph R. Biden was inaugurated as the 46th President of the United States and Kamala Harris is the first woman and person of South Asian and African American descent to be sworn in as Vice President. Listen to Encounter this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, since 2015, the Hack Lab Foundation, a non-profit organization based in Tema, Ghana, has been empowering the youth for future digital jobs through skills development, boot camps, hackathons, mentorship, coaching, and internships, and more importantly, job placement across Ghana, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and India to boot. Africa 54's Pauline Dio spoke with Foster Akugri, a Ghanaian social entrepreneur, founder, and Hack Lab Foundation president in Accra.
You are arguably one of the rising stars in Ghana. You've created a platform that has helped millions of young people who want to get into the technology space. Maybe let's start there.
We live in an equal world where not everyone has the opportunity and access to very, very connected and well-resourced people, creating a level playing field where there's less bias or is almost absolutely unbiased creates an opportunity for people to compete based on their talents, because talent is equally distributed, but opportunity isn't. And so the purpose of the Hack Lab Foundation and my life's mission is to help people find their path by creating that level playing field for them.
A lot of people talk about you as somebody who could be the next Bill Gates or the next Steve Jobs in Ghana. How did you come up with this program here?
Interesting. That's quite a benchmark to compare me to, but I appreciate that I am seeing towards that light, and it's positive, so I acknowledge and accept it in good faith. So the Hack Lab Foundation started 5 years ago, somewhere in 2015, just as an idea and as a one-time event, which was to bring together innovative students to develop their own solutions with support from a number of tech firms who were now emerging and breaking into the market with fintech solutions. Today, our community has grown to 10,700 people. We have placed people in jobs. In the last 2 years, we've placed over 700 people in jobs. We have designed a number of other initiatives that is centered around transitioning young people between the ages of 7 to 15 into technology and technology education, into building their careers in technology, and we call that the Hack Lab Junior. And so we want to help expose the young people to technology and kind of give them the opportunity to know what exists.
Let's talk about the other programs that you're working on. Take, for example, AI or artificial intelligence. You're big on that. Help us understand what AI is all about.
This year, we are focused on artificial intelligence. So every year, we choose one of the fourth industrial revolution technologies or the emerging technologies, and all our initiatives, programs, training programs, advocacy, policy, everything we do, hackathons, are focused on that particular theme. In 2021, we are focused on artificial intelligence. Now, the applications of artificial intelligence is currently immeasurable. We can't even tell where and where it can't be used. We'll be interfacing with each other. I will be speaking my Ghanaian dialect, and you will be speaking English. But by the time you finish speaking your English, I have heard it in my local dialect. And by the time I finish speaking my local dialect, you've heard it in English. And it is happening seamlessly. And we are having a conversation as if we were both speaking the same language. And that is the power of artificial intelligence, right? today artificial intelligence has broken into things like, it's been applied in things like augmented reality, virtual reality, which is allowing people to experience things firsthand as if they were right in front of them, but they are hundreds of thousands of miles away. And that is what globalization is all about, creating a global village powered by technology, but driven by artificial intelligence. And all these things can only be powerful if we have the right data collection tools. And that is the basis for which artificial intelligence would become the biggest technology we have ever seen.
The United Nations Mine Action Service, or UNMAS, in South Sudan says, following years of clearing unexploded ordnance in the country, many citizens who have been displaced from their ancestral land littered with various types of explosives during the more than 20-year conflict with Sudan are now able to return home. A senior official with the United Nations Mine Action Service says, while a huge chunk of land has been cleared and some residents can go back to farming their land, the task of getting rid of unexploded ordnance in South Sudan remains a challenge. For VOA, Waki Simon Wudu reports from the South Sudanese capital, Juba.
Clear for them detonation.
United Nations Mine Action Service workers detonate an exploded ordnance at Amei, a village located 135 kilometers southeast of Juba. Fire! UNMAS workers say even after clearing many landmines and an exploded ordnance, several littered remnants of explosives continue to pose danger to ordinary civilians. Okolo Joseph, a resident of Lokiliri Payam of Juba County in central Equatoria State, says his six-year-old son, James Wani, was hit by a landmine in April last year while playing with other children.
His colleagues got that object, doesn't know what is the use of that object. And then when she tried to collect also some of the colleagues, the kids, when she saw that they gathered together and then tried to chase the young ones away and then say, okay, leave us alone. At the end, when the rest tried to turn their back away from them, tried to throw that one between them. So that is how the incident happened.
Joseph says Wani still feels severe pain in the leg injured by the landmine and cannot do much for himself without assistance.
For him to move without his stick is a problem. I am sure this guy could not be able to do anything for himself because limb is important for you to stand, maybe digging and then maybe moving to collect something. At least that limb is to accompany you where you are going. So, but if I can see, his life is not really normalized either.
Lokiliri resident Mario Ladu says his 13-year-old son Michael Ladule was struck by an unexploded ordnance in August last year. Ladu says Michael and other children were playing with an unidentified object they found on the ground when it suddenly exploded. Ladu says Michael was badly injured in his head.
His situation is not very bad. He is no longer normal as he used to be because the injury in the head has gone very bad with him. He stays, but his life is no longer active like he used to be. The wound in the head appears like it has cured, but when you watch it closely, you can realize that he still has problem.
UNMAS officials say among the many unexploded ordnance that have been located, removed and detonated are Russian-made cluster munitions. They were dropped in thousands across parts of South Sudan during the 21-year civil war between the SPLM-A and the Khartoum government. UNMAS officials say years of clearing an exploded ordnance have made it possible for thousands of South Sudanese families to return home and farm the land again. 35-year-old Charles Tombe, who fled Amei village during the SPLM-A Khartoum conflict, returned home in 2011, has been farming ever since.
The places they have cleared help us. They give us freedom to use whether walking and working in them. It helps us a lot. And places they have marked as dangerous help and prevent us from encroaching them, because we already know they are dangerous.
Mike Rasit Fuller is a senior official with the South Sudan Mine Action Authority.
The biggest challenge will be the explosive remnants of war, like the UXOs, Lenin said, unexploded ordnance, which are all over in the battlefields and in the confrontation areas.
UNMAS official Richard Bolter says recent conflicts between the government and armed groups in South Sudan have slowed efforts to demine the entire country.
But while insecurity reigns, then banditry will remain prevalent. And it makes it very hard to send a team out with several vehicles, some high-priced kits, some food and some money and some fuel. They become a very attractive target for robbers.
UNMAS says a total of 1,404 people across South Sudan have been killed by various unexploded ammunitions, and more than 3,700 others have been injured by the devices since 2004. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
The UN Human Rights Office expresses alarm over increasing intercommunal violence in Sudan's Darfur region. Over the past week, a report deadly incident of two separate intercommunal violence have killed more than 200 people and injured hundreds more. The agency is calling on the government to urgently scale up protective measures in the region. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Clashes erupted between armed men of the Masalit and Arab communities last weekend in a camp for internally displaced people in West Darfur. The violence reportedly left 160 people dead and 215 injured. In a separate incident in South Darfur Monday, fighting between armed men from the Falata and Reziga tribes reportedly killed 72 people and injured 73 others. In both cases, UN Human Rights spokeswoman Ravina Shamdasani says intercommunal violence was triggered by the killing of a member of one of the rival communities.
What is very worrying is, given the lack of security in these areas and given the lack of accountability for crimes and human rights violations, people are feeling emboldened to take the law into their own hands. And a single incident can really very easily spark intercommunal conflict that can lead to many people being killed and displaced.
The UN Human Rights Office is calling on the government of Sudan to promptly ensure the full implementation of its national plan for the protection of civilians in Darfur. Shamdasani notes the government said it would deploy a joint force composed of 12,000 security officers to the region. She adds that has not happened.
These incidents raise serious concerns about the imminent risk of further violence in Darfur, in an environment where decades-old ethnic and tribal tensions that were further stoked by the previous regime continue to fester. There are severe gaps in protection by state authorities, as well as a lack of accountability for violations.
The UN agency is urging Sudanese authorities to carry out a thorough investigation into the deadly incidents and to ensure individual perpetrators are brought to justice. Accountability for crimes, it says, is crucial in breaking the cycle of armed citizens taking the law into their own hands to avenge attacks on members of their communities. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Nampa, ay sukari, nampa, ay sugar, sukari.
janja yu mjasi fanya jisi na mjasi aja yu jana vitanga wisi baba janja chukua vyote chukua vitafune ganja ganja chakua maya chakua ujibuti na karanga tuliza na kitumbua ya dhari na majanga we usije ukaugua mana
Benji Classics.
Shiba. They call me already.
Inna the club, boy, come no deform. Move for me, oh yeah, shaky bum bum. Bend your waist, make a feel a ring tan. Boy, me I like it when you do that, I get them. Dirty, dirty, go, let it go. Oh, di dan dan, oh my bami Joe. Take it easy, no go break my bone. Hey. I go rock your body when you enter my zone.
tempted. Pulling back, give me the time and the location. I'll be on top, baby, now you'll be my motivation. When I'm on top,
that was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, Managing Editor Shaka Saleh, Reporter Douglas Mpuga, and Producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, when the monkey can't reach the ripe banana with his hand, he says it is not sweet. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.